Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're taking you on a journey through medieval drinking culture.
Drinking horns, clay cups, silver goblets, sounds like simple objects at first, doesn't it? But these vessels tell us an incredible amount about the people who used them.
That's a good point. A drinking vessel was never just a container for liquids. It was a status symbol, sometimes a religious artifact, and in some cases a genuine work of art.
Exactly. And when you look at the range, from the simplest wooden cups to silver goblets studded with gemstones, you can immediately see the social hierarchy of the Middle Ages.
Although not all wood was created equal. Hardwoods like maple, beech or birch were often preferred because they have a relatively neutral taste. Oak, not so much, because of the tannins.
And then, of course, there was clay and ceramics, metals like pewter, copper, silver.
And eventually, glass. So really a complete evolution of materials over the centuries.
This development also reflects technological progress. From simple, unglazed earthenware to fine stoneware, those are enormous leaps in craftsmanship. Porcelain in the Middle Ages was only available as an expensive import from China.
What fascinates me about this? The regional differences were enormous. In the Rhineland, salt-glazed stoneware dominated. In southern Europe, majolica was widespread. Each region developed its own style, shaped by local resources and craft traditions.
And here's an interesting point that deserves a closer look. You often hear that people in the Middle Ages only drank beer and wine because the water was so contaminated.
That's one of those typical myths that just won't go away.
In fact, people back then knew perfectly well the difference between good and bad water. Flowing, clear spring water was considered safe. In the countryside, water from wells and springs was completely normal.
It became more problematic in growing cities, where shallow wells sometimes drew from the same water table as latrines. But that varied greatly by region.
And the high consumption of beer and wine had other reasons too. It was about calories. There's a reason for the old saying, beer is half a meal.
The small beer back then often had only about 2% alcohol. It really was more of a food than an intoxicant.
On top of that, there were social and cultural reasons. Wine and beer were table beverages, status markers, part of festive culture and religious rituals.
That also explains why the vessels themselves were so important. If drinking is a social act, then the vessel becomes
a statement. A noble host offering a silver goblet demonstrates power and generosity.
While the common peasant enjoyed his small beer from a turned wooden cup just the same. Functional, practical, affordable.
And that's exactly what makes these drinking vessels so valuable to us today as historical sources. They tell us about trade routes, technical expertise, and social structures.
You notice this especially in reenactment. When you hold an authentically recreated vessel in your hands, you get a completely different feel for the era than you would from books alone.
Absolutely. The tactile feel, the weight, the surface. These are things you have to experience.
What particularly interests me, how did ceramic technology actually develop? The leap from simple earthenware to glazed stoneware must have been enormous.
Oh, there's a lot to tell. Glazes didn't just improve functionality, making the vessels waterproof. They also opened up entirely new possibilities for artistic design.
All sorts of finishing techniques developed, with real craftsmanship behind them.
And each of these techniques tells its own story about cultural exchange, trade routes, and the people who passed on these skills through generations. When it comes to materials, let's start at the very beginning, with wood. It's one of the earliest, most widespread materials for drinking vessels, alongside ceramics, which is actually more commonly found in archaeological records.
And for good reason. The advantages are obvious. Easy to make, inexpensive, available practically everywhere. Wooden cups also kept drinks pleasantly cool and were relatively shatterproof.
When it came to wood types, people were quite particular. Maple, beech, birch, those were the most common. Oak, on the other hand, was less common, as we heard earlier, because of the tannins. After all, you wanted to taste the drink, not the wood.
Although the issue of flavors was a real concern, softer woods could absorb tastes. If you've ever drunk cider from a cup that was previously used constantly for beer...
It was quite an interesting taste experience. That's exactly why harder woods were preferred. They were much less porous.
What fascinates me, the manufacturing techniques were remarkably sophisticated. Usually, the vessels were turned from a single piece of wood on a lathe. Less commonly, some were assembled from individual staves, similar to barrels.
And with higher quality pieces, elaborate carvings and decorations were added. At that point, it was no longer a simple everyday object, but...
a sign of wealth. A decorated wooden cup with carved work was significantly more expensive than a plain turned piece.
You could also tell a lot from the quality of craftsmanship. Consistent wall thickness, cleanly cut tool marks, a symmetrical shape. All of this revealed an experienced turner.
And how did people back then care for their wooden vessels? I mean, untreated wood.
Absorbs everything. Liquids, odors, fats. That's why the vessels were treated. Linseed oil was widely used, sometimes beeswax as well. This sealed the pores and protected the wood.
By the way, that still works the same way today. If you use an authentic wooden cup for reenactment, the combination of linseed oil and beeswax is still the best approach. Food safe and historically accurate.
But alongside wood, ceramics naturally played a central role. And their development was truly revolutionary.
Revolutionary how?
The development went from simple, unglazed earthenware, basically fired clay, to fine stoneware. These advances allowed for thinner-walled, more elegant vessels.
Yes, and these glazes were the key. They not only made the vessels suitable for everyday use, but also served as a canvas for impressive artistic development.
Techniques like sgraffito, that's the scratching through an applied layer of color to reveal the clay beneath, or underglaze painting and relief decorations were perfected. There's real artistry behind that.
And as you mentioned earlier, each region developed its own style. I find that particularly fascinating.
Absolutely. As we briefly touched on earlier, salt-glazed stoneware dominated in the Rhineland. The salt glaze is created when salt is thrown into the kiln during firing. It reacts with the clay and forms that characteristic slightly glossy surface.
The pieces from the Rhineland were known throughout Europe. Export goods, you could say.
Meanwhile, in southern Europe, in Italy and Spain, Majolica ware was widespread. That's ceramic with an opaque white tin glaze onto which colored motifs were then painted.
They also look completely different. Majolica is often more colorful, more Mediterranean, while Rhenish stoneware tends to have those earthy browns and grays.
These regional differences reflected local resources, but also craft traditions and cultural influences. An experienced collector can often tell at a glance where a piece comes from.
It's like a signature. The choice of material, the glazing technique, the decoration, all of this reveals not just something about the owner, but also about the entire region and era.
And just imagine, a wealthy citizen who could afford a glazed stoneware jug was making a much bigger statement than someone with a simple wooden cup.
The quality of the ceramic was immediately apparent. Thin-walled vessels with elaborate painting, that was luxury. Coarse earthenware with uneven glaze, on the other hand, was mass-produced everyday wear.
Interestingly, both had their place. The everyday cup had to be sturdy, not beautiful. But for special occasions,
the good tableware came out.
Some things never change.
Let's move on to the finer materials. Pewter was the metal of the rising bourgeoisie. Affordable enough to become widespread, yet with that attractive silver appearance.
Pewter smiths developed remarkably sophisticated techniques. Delicate decorations, coats of arms, complex patterns, and the smooth metal appeared hygienic. However, historical alloys often contained lead, which was problematic with acidic beverages.
What interests me, how do you actually identify genuine historical pewter? The casting quality is a good indicator, as is the type of hallmarks, and the alloy itself. Pewter was often mixed with small amounts of other metals.
This composition reveals a lot about origin and date of creation. An experienced collector can often assess that.
But for the truly wealthy, pewter was of course just the beginning. Silver was the real status symbol. There was no doubt about that.
Silver drinking vessels demonstrated wealth at first glance. Nobles had their cups and goblets adorned with elaborate engravings, sometimes even set with gemstones.
And silver had another practical advantage, its antibacterial properties. While people at the time couldn't explain this scientifically, experience showed that silver vessels were considered particularly pure.
Although that was of course also part of the prestige. A silver cup signaled, someone important is drinking here.
Between the luxury of silver and the affordability of pewter, there were other options. Copper was popular for its warm luster.
It simply looked good. And bronze, that alloy of copper and tin, was robust enough for everyday use.
These were, so to speak, the materials for the upper middle class. Not as prestigious as silver, but much more durable and affordable for the general population.
And then, at some point, glass came into play. At first, it was an absolute luxury. Only the nobility and the church could afford it.
The elaborate manufacturing process made it so exclusive. Glassmaking required specialized knowledge, high temperatures, expensive raw materials. And then Venetian glass.
That was the absolute pinnacle. The glassblowers on Murano were legendary for their artistry.
The Venetians guarded their secrets like state treasures. The glassblowers were practically forbidden from leaving the island. They faced confiscation, loss of privileges, and those who fled anyway were pursued by agents abroad. Still, some managed to make it to France or Bohemia. That's how sought after these masters were.
Oh, and the techniques they developed. By adding metal oxides, different colors could be achieved. Green and blue were particularly popular. Decoration was done by applying glass threads or pressing patterns into the still hot mass.
That required incredible precision and timing. One wrong moment and everything was ruined.
Over time, quite distinctive forms developed. There was the Krautstrunk.
That sturdy beaker with the applied glass prunts. The name actually comes from its resemblance to a cabbage stalk.
The Berkemeyer was more elegant. A chalice-shaped glass with a wide foot. It was essentially the precursor to the Römer glass that we still know today.
And then there were the winged glasses. Those were
true masterpieces. Delicate glass wings on the stem, sometimes coiled like serpents. They were individually shaped in the heat and crimped with tongs.
Each wing was a separate attachment to the still hot stem. A single mistake with these paper-thin walls
mostly façon de Venise, meaning German-Dutch production in the Venetian style, and the entire piece was lost. That's why so few originals have survived.
These glasses were never intended for everyday use. They were showpieces, prestige objects for courts and the patrician class. They were admired more than they were actually drunk from.
Interestingly, some of these forms have survived to this day. The Bäckermeier lives on in the Römer glass, still known for Rhine and Moselle wines, just industrially produced rather than hand-blown.
The craftsmanship behind it has become rare today. What once required years of training on Murano is now mostly replaced by machine precision.
Although there are still artisans who master these old techniques, replicas based on historical models are still being made for collectors today.
That shows how fascinating these objects remain. A well-made glass vessel based on a medieval model, that's not just a drinking vessel, it's a window into the past. Let's take a closer look at the different vessel forms. In the daily life of the common people, simple cups and mugs dominated, turned from wood or shaped from clay, plain and functional.
The forms were usually straight or slightly flared. No decorations, no frills. The main thing was that the vessel was watertight and felt good in the hand.
It was quite different with chalices. They played a central role in Christian liturgy, for presenting the consecrated wine during the celebration of the Eucharist.
High-quality chalices were often made of gold or silver, though gilt copper was also common. Often richly decorated with enamels, gemstones and elaborate engravings.
A famous example is the Tassilo chalice from the 8th century. It's now in Kremsmünster Abbey in Austria and shows the high regard in which these liturgical objects were held. Gilt copper with silver inlays and...
And those typical Anglo-Saxon animal ornaments. A true masterpiece of early medieval goldsmith work.
Outside the church, there were secular ceremonial vessels. Particularly impressive were the so-called welcome goblets.
Those were presented to guests as a greeting?
Yes, often decorated with elaborate engravings, gemstones or enamel work. At noble courts and in wealthy bourgeois households, they served to display rank. Presenting a filled welcome goblet was a sign of hospitality and respect.
Drinking together from one vessel had a deeper meaning as well. It created trust and strengthened relationships.
Which brings us to one of my favorite topics, drinking horns.
They have a very special aura.
They were mostly made from ordinary domestic cattle. The thing about giant aurochs is actually more of a modern myth. We rarely find that archaeologically. They symbolized strength and fertility. And in Norse mythology, they played an important role.
You mean the stories with Odin and the mead?
Exactly. The mead of poetry called Odrörir. Odin steals it from the giants, drinks it, and brings it to Asgard. Whoever tastes it gains wisdom and the gift of poetry. The horn became a symbol of divine inspiration.
And then there's that story with Thor.
At Utgarda Loki's. Thor has to drink from a seemingly ordinary horn, but the horn is secretly connected to all the seas. He can't empty it, but he drinks so deeply that the sea level drops.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
The horn as a test of divine power. No wonder drinking horns played such a central role at feasts and ceremonies.
In medieval Europe, they were often used as symbols of hospitality and community. Drinking together from the horn solidified alliances and loyalties.
You still see this today at reenactment events. Passing the horn has something ritualistic about it. It creates connection. You're literally sharing something with each other.
Many of these horns were richly decorated, with metal fittings, gemstones, or carvings. Particularly valuable specimens were passed down as heirlooms in noble houses.
And then with beer culture, entirely new forms developed.
Tankards and steins, especially in the German-speaking regions.
Tankards were characterized by their cylindrical shape. Some also had lids. They came in glass, stoneware, or pewter, and they became a symbol of German beer culture, especially in the early modern period.
By the way, the lid also served a practical purpose. It kept flies and dirt out of the drink. Sometimes this is associated with times of plague, but that's not actually well documented.
Well, one of several reasons. Status symbol, practical handling with a thumb lever, and guild interests probably played a role as well. In any case, the lid has persisted to this day.
Salt-glazed stoneware jugs were already widespread from the 14th century and reached their peak in the 16th century. And the decoration ranged from simple incisions to, how should I put it, really elaborate reliefs.
The apostle jugs.
Yes, decorated with depictions of the 12 apostles. These were small works of art in themselves. Many jugs also bore inscriptions or dates, making them personal mementos.
Heraldic symbols, guild marks, scenes from daily life. From the decoration, you could often tell who used the jug and what community they belonged to.
What's interesting is that many of these forms have survived to this day. The Maßkrug at Oktoberfest is essentially a descendant of these early modern steins.
A tradition that has lasted for centuries. And drinking from a stein is still a communal experience, whether at a folk festival or at a reenactment. What particularly fascinates me about medieval drinking culture is this clear social hierarchy reflected in the vessels. A glance at someone's cup immediately revealed who you were dealing with.
The nobleman with his silver goblet, often set with gemstones. The wealthy citizen with his pewter mug. And the simple peasant with his turned wooden cup.
These differences were intentional and deliberately displayed. At feasts, people didn't present their precious goblets just for drinking. They were a statement.
Power and influence demonstrated through a drinking vessel. It worked because everyone knew and understood these codes.
But it wasn't just about displaying wealth. The rituals around drinking also served a bonding function.
The welcome drink, for example. Guests were greeted with a filled cup. This was widespread and signaled hospitality and respect.
And then the ritual of toasting. The mutual raising of glasses. That had enormous social significance. It strengthened relationships and showed appreciation.
It was more than politeness. In a time when trust was vital, drinking together signified a kind of contract.
At feasts and banquets, special drinking customs came into play. Drinking from horns was often tied to tests of courage. Who could empty the horn in one go?
And whoever could manage it often had to get a refill or buy a round. Competitive drinking was a regular part of festive culture.
These rituals strengthened solidarity. You shared something, you proved yourself, you belonged. It was an essential part of social life.
Though it gets interesting with the origins of some customs. People sometimes say that clinking glasses originated from wanting to test the authenticity of a drink by striking them together.
Or that liquid would splash over during clinking, thus ruling out poison?
That's a popular story, but historically rather questionable. There's little evidence that this was the actual origin. It's more likely that clinking glasses simply evolved from the custom of toasting. People raised their vessels and showed them to each other.
That makes more sense. A symbolic gesture of connection, not a practical test.
Yes, and interestingly, these rituals have survived to this day. We still clink glasses, say prosit or cheers.
The word prosit comes from Latin, may it benefit you, a direct connection across centuries.
What has changed, however, are the hygiene aspects.
Yes, drinking together from one vessel back then was
a real problem. Shared cups or jugs could contribute to the spread of diseases.
In response, certain cleaning practices developed. Vessels were rinsed with vinegar or hot water. But that only helped to a limited extent.
The growing awareness of hygiene then led to the development of personal drinking vessels, especially among the wealthier classes.
Which of course also emphasized one's own status. Whoever could afford their own vessel demonstrated not just hygiene awareness, but also wealth.
The two aspects, status and health, reinforced each other.
You still see this today at reenactment events. Everyone brings their own cup, their own horn. It's practical, but it also connects to this historical tradition.
And passing around a shared horn on special occasions becomes even more meaningful.
That's true. When a drinking horn is passed around at an event today, it's deliberately ritualistic. You're sharing something, trusting each other.
This connection between past and present shows how deeply these drinking rituals are rooted in our culture. The vessels change, but the human longing for community and belonging remains. What continually fascinates me about this topic, many of these medieval vessel forms have survived the centuries and still influence our drinking culture today.
The classic wine glass, for example. Its roots lie directly in medieval goblet forms. The curved bowl, the elegant stem.
And the beer stein we see today at Oktoberfest or in traditional taverns is essentially a descendant of early modern tankards and stone jugs.
What's changed, of course, is the production. Industrially manufactured rather than hand-turned or hand-thrown.
Although in the reenactment scene there's a genuine renaissance of craftsmanship, the demand for authentic replicas has led to traditional techniques being revived.
Potters, glassblowers, metal workers. They're making drinking vessels based on historical models again. That's active preservation of cultural heritage.
And these replicas aren't just used as props. Many people also use them in everyday life to keep the connection to history.
Alive! That's exactly the point.
Although with authentic replicas, you should pay attention to a few things. The materials, the workmanship, the historical model.
With wooden vessels, for example, is it really treated with linseed oil or beeswax? With ceramics, does the glazing technique match the era you want to portray?
With metals, it gets even more interesting. Real pewter has different properties than modern alloys. And with drinking horns, is the inside properly sealed?
That might sound pedantic, but these details make the difference between a costume piece and a genuine piece of history that you hold in your hands.
What we've seen in this episode. From simple wooden cups to magnificent silver goblets. From drinking horns with mythological significance to stone jugs with apostle depictions. These vessels tell us an incredible amount about the people who used them.
About social structures, craftsmanship, religious beliefs, cultural customs. A simple drinking vessel as a window into an entire society.
And the beautiful thing is, we can still experience this connection to the past today. At the next medieval market, at a reenactment event, or simply by consciously choosing a historically inspired vessel.
Drinking together, sharing a moment. That works just as well today as it did 800 years ago.
If you've become curious and want to dive deeper, at battlemerchant.com you'll find not only a wide selection of historical drinking vessels, but also many more fascinating topics about history and the Middle Ages on the blog.
And with that, we've reached the end of our journey through medieval drinking culture.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this topic as much as we did.
Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.